在原来人家的物质，在原来外的半个方，在原来地基的太阳，在原来外的大势力，在原来都黑亮，在原来外的分散漫，在原来土地加满万，在原来土地。
On WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPVLP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Bryce Claypool with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, September 2nd. Last week, Sarasota County Commissioners heard from residents before making up their minds about the fate of the historic Blackburn Point Swing Bridge. Built in 1926, the bridge connects Casey Key to the mainland. Its condition is deteriorating, and the county is considering its options for the bridge, which is an essential hurricane evacuation route. Options include replacing the bridge with a drawbridge or a new swing bridge, or maintaining the existing structure at an estimated cost of $16 million by 2038. The commission will hear more options in future meetings. The overwhelming sentiment from citizens last week was the need to preserve the bridge's historic value and, quote, old Florida charm. Two St. Petersburg pastors were arrested on Friday for kneeling in prayer on a Black History Matters mural to obstruct crews attempting to remove it. The arrests are the latest chapter in Florida's efforts to erase art on roadways and sidewalks. They coincide with similar arrests of protesters who used chalk in an attempt to restore the recently erased memorial crosswalk at the site of the Pulse massacre in Orlando. In that case, the Florida Department of Transportation warned, quote, vandalizing state property and/or disrupting traffic in any way is unsafe and illegal. Lobbyists for a right-wing news network pushed for a new state law defunding media fact-checkers. The revelations come after a public records request by journalist Jason Garcia revealed the story behind a law banning state agencies from working with, quote, media reliability and bias monitors. The language was added to the bill at the behest of network Newsmax, known for its close ties to President Trump and for spreading false claims of fraud in the 2020 election. Newsmax said in a statement that the law was a victory against censorship. Last week, Moat Marine Laboratory and Aquarium celebrated the opening of three new seagrass research facilities. The facilities, located at Moat's Aquaculture Research Park, are part of an initiative established through the Florida legislature to help reverse the statewide decline of seagrass. Focused on science and innovation, the new spaces will house research on how different stressors impact seagrass, what genetic variations are most resilient, and whether seagrasses can effectively sequester carbon and fight climate change. This has been Bryce Claypool with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, September 2nd.
You're listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is show 68 of our changing environment. The previous show was Corduroy, hosted by Sebastian. I'm John O'Miller, filling in for Julie Morris, who's in the Boundary Waters, and this show is being recorded and broadcast on September 2nd, 2025. Today we'll be chatting with activist, attorney, and East County resident Susan Shetley, who's the leader with Sarasota Citizen Action Network and president of Keep the Country Country. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. Susan, it's great to have you on the show. Let's start by having you explain how you know so much about a relatively obscure provision of Florida law known as FLUDRA.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you inviting me to talk with you today. I am becoming familiar with the FLUDRA process because I'm assisting Sarasota Audubon Society in opposing development and rezone on property adjacent to celery fields called the Smith Farm. So the rezone was denied by the Board of County Commissioners, and now the D.R. Horton, who's the developer that wants to develop the land, has filed a challenge to that rezone denial.
So, but to rewind for a second, it was also not recommended by the Planning Commission. Is that right?
That's correct. The Planning Commission recommended denial. I believe it was a 6-4 vote against the rezone. And the County Commission vote was unanimously opposed to denying the rezone.
So if we look back over the last 5 or 10 years at the number of development proposals that are recommended against by the Planning Commission and then denied 5-0 by the Commission, there wouldn't be a very long list, would there?
I'm guessing you could probably count them on one hand.
Right.
So I don't know for sure.
This is sort of a big deal.
Yeah, a very big deal.
Okay. And so what's your background that led Audubon to think you'd be a good assistant in this effort?
Well, part of that was I volunteered. So that was part of it. But I have a background. My undergraduate degree was a bachelor's in landscape architecture from LSU. I'm not going to give dates because that makes me feel really, really old. Then I moved to Alaska and worked for a consulting engineering firm up there for 3 years. So I, more than most attorneys, I got exposed to actual nuts and bolts of building and planning. Then I came back down to the lower 48 and went to law school at University of Colorado, Boulder. graduated from there. Then I worked for a boutique law firm in Kansas City, Frawley, Kleckner, Carlisle, and Shortledge. And they were a leader really in doing growth management and local government law across the entire country. Sarasota County was one of our clients. So I did a lot of the early work on the county's impact fee programs. Then when the county decided to staff up an in-house county attorney's office, at one point they realized they needed somebody with my niche focus. And so I came and started in the county attorney's office in late 1993 and worked there for a little over 10 years. And then in 2005, I opened my own solo practice, still doing similar kind of work. I mostly work for local governments on revenue mechanisms, mostly impact fees and special assessments.
Okay.
So while I was with the county attorney's office, I came in at the beginning of the current assessment program development for stormwater and was there during the time period when the Celery Fields was acquired by the county and developed into the regional stormwater facility that it is.
Okay, well, let's, although I think most of our listeners know what the Celery Fields is, but could you give a brief background on the Celery Fields?
Sure. The Celery Fields historically was sawgrass marsh land. In the early 1900s, it started being converted into agricultural land. Reading historical documents, apparently they tried a bunch of different crops, right. And it ended up with celery because celery takes a lot of water, and there happens to be a lot of water that hangs out on the celery fields all the time. So it really was farmed as celery. I remember seeing that when I was first living here.
Wow.
So they, you know, go because I lived out east. So so the Celery Fields is 400 plus or minus acres. If you think of it, it's east of the interstate, south of Fruitville Road. And it's roughly in the shape of a large rectangle standing on its narrow end. And it's about 1.3 miles in height and about a half a mile across. And if you think about that entire rectangle, the bottom right-hand corner biting into that rectangle is Smith Farm.
Right.
So it is, to an aerial photograph looking at it right now, you would think the Smith Farm was part of Celery Fields because it has not yet been developed. And it physically looks like it should be part of the regional facility.
So what happens with muck soils is that they oxidize. They're organic soils, and when they're exposed to air and not kept wet, the organic matter is depleted. And so over time, we've seen this both in the Everglades and at the celery fields, the amount of muck diminishes. And so as the productivity of the celery fields diminished, it eventually became harder and harder to make it work. Is it going agricultural operation, and people are probably familiar, there's a packing house cafe. With agriculture, you not only need a product, but you need a way to process it. And if you don't have the infrastructure to deal with the crop. So to make a long story short, eventually it really ceased being a very productive agricultural area, and rather than letting it go, like restoring it to a wetland, the county identified it as sort of a, was it a major employment center, or they had a couple of different uses proposed for there, is that right?
Well, for portions of it,
right.
They had it as sort of light industrial.
Yeah, and so the county bought it, but they had, it was a deal where they had to buy more land than they wanted. And so we ended up with some of it as a stormwater system and some of it with this light industrial, which does flood periodically.
Yeah, the whole area is definitely
right.
in a floodplain.
It's predisposed to flooding.
Yes.
And it's going to stay that way. Okay.
And so the area you're talking about that didn't become directly part of the stormwater facility is commonly referred to as the Quads. And it's land to the west of the northwest corner of the Celery Fields proper. And so some of that land, in cooperation with Sarasota Audubon Society, is being rewilded, I think is the term they use, to provide additional buffering from the light industrial uses that are occupying some of that land to the Celery Fields proper. And there has been a lot of wetlands restoration work, mostly to improve habitat for birds, because a serendipitous event occurred is that as this stormwater facility was developed and more of those lands retained water all the time and restored habitat, birds decided that they really, really liked this area. And Sarasota Audubon began doing bird surveys in the area in early 2001. And to date, and this may be a little bit dated information, but over 246 different species of birds have been spotted there, and it's on some of the major migration paths of some of the birds. So it blossomed into something more than just a stormwater facility.
Right, and the stormwater facility was created because of a history of flooding in the Philippi Creek Basin, and so this was this land became an opportunity to store water and help deal with these flood events, even though it's probably not enough. You know, for every flood, there's a bigger flood out there. Just because you call something a 100-year flood, there's also a 150-year flood. And so all these systems are designed for a particular level of water, and that there's no guarantee there won't be more water at some point.
No, and Debbie certainly gave
right.
us a little bit of a glimmer of what that looks like last year. So.
Okay. So the Smith family owned this farm that was sort of on the edge, but clearly part of the historic Celery Fields. And they either approached or were approached by a company called D.R. Horton. And the proposal was to create a conservation subdivision. Is that right?
No, actually, it's they were going for a planned unit development,
okay.
which has some similar planning
okay.
philosophy underneath it. Since this is west of the urban service boundary,
okay.
It comes under different options for zoning.
All right.
So D.R. Horton was originally asking for planned unit development RSF2, which is 3.5 units per acre maximum. And that would have been 170 units that they were proposing to put on this land. It's about 50 acres in size. Interestingly, it started out less than 50 acres in the application, and somehow they found some more acreage as the process went through. And their design proposal for the land, which has not really changed, is a narrow buffer area around the perimeter of the property. It's roughly like a square shape with rounded edges. And then on the inside of that would be one ring of houses, lots all the way around. Then the interior access road would be the next ring in. The next ring in is another line of houses going all around. And then the entire center part of the property, which is well over 50% of the land, is a stormwater detention facility to serve that development. So you end up with just this massive area of stormwater pond in the middle, and then one set of houses, a narrow neighborhood road, and then another ring of houses, and you're right there in the middle, you know, jutting into the celery fields.
Right, and we had this peculiar finding in Sarasota that a big open pond like that is considered open space.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking. And that's happened gradually over time,
yeah.
But it's become very clear that this is the way it's going,
yeah.
On all this. I believe they still don't allow golf courses to be counted as open space, which in my mind would make more sense,
yeah.
to allow that to count as open space. But so, and some of the areas are allowed to put community facilities in open space.
Yeah.
So in Sarasota County, open space is not what most of us would think,
right.
is open space.
Yeah, yeah. It's having a big flat body of water like that is like calling a parking lot open space. Well, there are no buildings there.
Right,
so
right.
Space.
You can look across,
yeah.
it. But.
All right. So we've got both the Planning Commission recommending against and the County Commission voting against. And the owners and the D.R. Horton were not happy with that outcome, and they are initiating a process called FLUDRA. Is that right?
Yes, they filed a petition under the Florida Land Use and Environmental Dispute Resolution Act.
There you go.
So FLUDRA. That's why we call it FLUDRA, because right. who can say all that stuff?
Right.
And really what it does, it's a specific statutory process that was created by our Florida legislature, and its intent really, I believe, is to provide time for the local government and the applicant, the developer, to have time to discuss possible resolution. From the date of official notification of the denial, which is not the date of the public hearing, there's some legal, technical stuff that has to happen. But under our statutes, for that denial to be appealed, the applicant only has 20 days, which does not really allow much time to negotiate for any alternative other than ending up in court. So they've got 20 days to file a certiorari, a challenge to the denial. So the legislature created this process to provide an option controlled by a special magistrate, which is not a judge, but it could be a judge hired to fill that position. In this case, it's an attorney in the area, Mark Barnaby. And they officiate through the process and actually serve specifically in the statute as a mediator. So the initial part of the FLUDRA process is for the applicant and the local government, in this case Sarasota County and D.R. Horton and the Smiths, will sit down and negotiate to see if there's some alternative that they can all agree on. So it could be, you know, drastically reduced density, could be something completely different. We don't know. Presumably all options would be on the table. The proceedings between the parties are privileged. So it's a protected time period when they can talk to each other about things that might be held against them if they were said in public. So it's a protected process, and the special magistrate serves as a mediator during that process.
So let me ask a 30,000-foot question. Do you think that was a good act for the legislature to pass that? Does it seem helpful?
I don't know.
Okay.
In my understanding, because I've been calling around to a lot of attorneys across the state trying to mm-hmm. become more familiar with the process, and I think in the past it had not been used a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I always think it's valuable for parties to sit down and discuss things, and it's always better to stay out of court if you can. I know that's
okay.
an odd thing for a lawyer to say, but that's sort of how I'd rather fix things than fight about them.
And am I right? It was only used once previously in Sarasota County?
To my knowledge, there's another FLUDRA process that just recently concluded, and that was related to a proposed oil change facility called Take Five down near Venice.
Okay.
And it has had the same special magistrate. And they did come up with a settlement proposal. So to just back up a second to the hearing process. So the first hearing for the Smith Farm Fludra process is scheduled for September 11th, 9 a.m. at the North County, Sarasota County Commission Chambers. So, but there's very little opportunity for members of the public to speak.
Right.
This is really for the two parties, and the parties are Sarasota County and D.R. Horton / Smith. So that first hearing will mostly be those parties off discussing possible settlement. So they did that in Take Five. They came up with a slightly modified development plan for Take Five. Then that goes back to the county commission for them to determine whether or not they agree with this settlement proposal.
Okay.
On Take Five, the board said no.
We don't like it.
Go back. Then the next part of the process, the next phase, or someone call it the second part of the process of the Fludra, is the special magistrate makes a determination of the validity of the local government's denial.
Oh.
So the applicant makes a presentation to the court or to the special magistrate, the county does, and then depending on the special magistrate's decision, certain members of the public can also contribute at that hearing. They may also have had an opportunity to comment on the proposed settlement, but that's pretty limited to people who spoke at the county's final public hearing back in February of 2025.
So, but I want to be clear, the magistrate is then in a position to determine whether the legal basis for the county's rejection of the project is valid?
Yes, he gets to write an opinion about that. He makes a recommendation.
And where does the recommendation go?
It goes to the county and to the state.
Oh.
Just as part of the process.
Okay.
But the opinion is not binding on the county.
Okay.
So he determines whether it was supported by substantial evidence.
Okay.
And also something that I don't believe would be a factor in a rezone determination directly, but he also looks at whether the county's denial unfairly burdens the property owner. So typically in more court cases on rezone denials, the court looks at, is there some other reasonable use of the property that's still available to the property owner?
Okay.
So this unfairly burdened is a little bit different from the language you see in most of the rezone cases. It's more of a Burt Harris type flavor.
Okay, let's avoid.
Sorry. I'm getting too in the weeds.
Burt Harris, if we can. So the magistrate is essentially offering his or her opinion on the strength or validity of the county's position.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And his opinion could also include some recommended alternatives.
Okay. And so where does it go from there? Now the magistrate is weighed in with his or her opinion. It comes back to the county?
It comes back to the county, and they look at it to see if they agree
that their
decision was erroneous. They look at the alternatives that might be proposed in the special magistrate's order and determine that they can say yes or no.
And so presumably part of the county's calculus in that situation is sort of seeing how strong a hand they have, like how likely they think they would be to prevail if it went to a legal challenge?
In part, it could be, although there's no new evidence introduced. So
so
it's not like D.R. Horton had an opportunity or should have an opportunity to introduce more evidence to shore up their position. Everything should be based on the evidence and testimony that was before the county commission when they made the decision.
Right. But the magistrate could be signaling to all parties that the county has a really good position here, or they could be signaling the county doesn't have as strong a position as it would like to.
I'm going to take the fifth on,
okay, all right.
on that one,
all
if
right.
you don't mind.
No, go ahead. That's fine.
So the special magistrate's order goes back to the county commission, and they decide whether they want to act upon it.
Right.
After that, if the county commission says no, we still stand by our decision, yeah. and we're not interested in any of these alternatives, then it's left to the applicant, D.R. Horton, or whatever, do they want to file a lawsuit?
Okay.
And then they – I believe D.R. Horton – so the clock stopped running on their 20 days on the day they filed their FLUDRA petition.
Okay.
And I believe at that point they had 2 days left. So they would have to act – I mean, but I'm sure they've got all of this stuff
out.
Prepared.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then you just have that. That part of the process move into the courts.
Okay, so we've already said that this is pretty unusual for both Planning Commission and the County Commission to be so clear about their position. What were the reasons or arguments given for turning down the D.R. Horton proposal for the Smith Farm?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. It ranged from a lot of different issues. And ties into a lot of comprehensive plan policies that the county has that they've not really been using much in the last decade or so. Our county comprehensive plan really has a lot of really strong policy arguments. So the main issues that were presented to the commission were incompatibility with surrounding area. So well, let me back up just 1 second to say that development approvals by statute must be found consistent with our comprehensive plan. So if something is found inconsistent with any part of the comprehensive plan, it should be denied. And our county attorney's even on record saying that to the county commission at a hearing on a rezone. So by law, all development approvals must be consistent with the comprehensive plan. So you look to the policies and the information in the comprehensive plan. So there were severe flooding of the Smith Farm property during Hurricane Debby, and it frequently floods significantly. So if they developed it, they would need to bring in really substantial amounts of fill and build that land up. Another issue is it's not compatible with, with surrounding development. The surrounding areas, some of them have higher density rezone capability, but they've actually developed at lower densities. So most of the area there is more low moderate type a residential density. And you have to look at the celery field itself is an adjacent land use. So all development has to be compatible with surrounding areas, surrounding densities, surrounding land uses. So the Smith Farm is adjacent to the celery fields, which is not only a stormwater facility, but also has become a very significant internationally renowned birding site. There are protections for those birds that migrate, the Migratory Birds Act. There are also threatened species of birds that have been identified in the celery fields. So that was another area. So the flooding risks, the problems that filling in on that site could cause for surrounding areas, particularly in a storm event that exceeds the level of service standard. As Steve Swa has taught me, if it's in the floodplain, at some point it's going to flood. That's
right.
Where the water wants to go.
That makes
yeah.
sense.
Yeah. So a lot of it was things like that really tied back to comprehensive plan policies on incompatibility, as well as the flooding and threat to public health, safety, and welfare.
So for our listeners, let me read just one of the future land use policies. This is 1.1.3, and it says, the generalized land use categories depicted on the future land use map as expressed under Goal 2 of this chapter are intended to establish varying degrees of environmental protection and intensity of development transitioning from the natural environment to the most intense developed areas by gradually increasing density and urban character. And one of the problems with this proposal is it's not particularly gradual. It's pretty abrupt. So you're listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I want to tell our listeners that Sobey Gardens presents the High Life Contemporary Photography and Birds from July 19th through September 14th at their downtown Sarasota campus. This exhibition will feature 70 works by more than 50 photographers from around the world. The works will be presented in the galleries of the Museum of Botany and Arts and outside throughout the gardens. More information is available at selby.org or by calling 941-366-5731. Sarasota County will host, oh, that's another one. So just hold that number, 941-366-5731. Okay, back to you, Susan.
Yeah, so one of the arguments that the development community in Sarasota County have been making for a long time is that they have a right to these higher densities. So you've got the existing zoning, which in this case would allow one dwelling unit per 5 acres. Then you've also got the future land use map, which is in the county's comprehensive plan. Many of the developers have been coming in and getting significant increases in density approved by the county commission by claiming that they've got a right to that future land use designation. But Florida courts have not gone to that. They do not support that. Florida law does not require that a local government rezone land to allow the maximum density identified in the future land use plan. In fact, the statute requires a local government to apply all objective policies, use, density, intensity limits, and other criteria in the comp plan, as well as all the criteria in our Unified Development Code to determine whether the density that's proposed is appropriate for that land. And the comprehensive plan in Lee County versus Sunbelt Equities, the court said, comprehensive plan represents, in effect, a future ceiling above which development should not proceed. It does not establish anything in between that.
There's no floor.
Correct. Yeah. Well, the floor would be the existing zoning.
Right.
And so anything in between there has to meet all these criteria of – and the main one on developments like this is compatibility. So compatibility shows up in multiple – policies in our comprehensive plan, and I'll just bore people a second by reading a couple of them. I'll give you the number references in case anybody wants to look them up. So development is required to be compatible in policy 2.1.2, 1.2.17, 2.3.6, and 2.3.7. So you've got multiple policies in different parts of the comprehensive plan that require compatibility. If a proposed development is not compatible, then it's inconsistent with the comprehensive plan. So it's sort of two layers of issues, but incompatibility means it's not consistent with the comprehensive plan. And it's an area that our board has not used in their reasoning much in past decades, but we have a board now that is – looking at those issues in more detail. And in fact, on this one, as I recall, all five county commissioners went on record saying this was not compatible with the surrounding area, including the celery fields proper. So it's a land use that any proposed development on Smith Farm would need to be compatible with.
So we have the zoning, and maybe we shouldn't get into zoning, but how was the future land use map, or how did it come to pass that the Smith Farm got assigned a future land use category?
The development or the planning process that goes into the future land use map, when I was in design school, we called them blob maps. And this is more refined than a blob map, but it's looking at things from, the 10,000 feet up in the air view. It is west of the urban service boundary, so it is part of what would be considered the part of the county that historically was going to be developed at a higher density as opposed to what used to be considered staying rural east of the urban service boundary. But the 2050 plan approval sort of wiped out the protection for the rural areas. So the future land use map may have not considered the on-the-ground details because that would be figured out at the rezone stage. So you could develop properties like this by being more sensitive to on-the-ground factors.
Yeah.
So, for example, the I believe it's the southeast portion of Smith Farms is actually not in the floodplain. So you could come up with a development approach that aggregated some lower amount of density in that area. So you could be more responsive to the facts on the ground. And at the level of planning that the future future land use map is, they're looking more at where would development potentially be allowed, what densities might be appropriate in terms of moving from the dense urban area of city of Sarasota and surrounding area to the rural areas. And they're not going to be as worried about exactly where does the floodplain show up.
Apparently.
Yeah. So, well, but, you know, at the level, they're talking about planning policy stuff. And you can deal with on-site things at the stage of the specific rezone. And in fact, our both the comp plan and the UDC, which is the Unified Development Code, contain language that say, basically, I'm paraphrasing here, no matter what the future land use map says, if the conditions on the site aren't appropriate for development, basically, some land simply shouldn't be developed.
That's the override, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's been lost in the shuffle to a certain extent. So, I mean, you think of the scale, you know, the future land use map, it is divided into two sections, one north county and one south county. At that scale, you really can't depict the details of the floodplain on Smith Farm.
So do you remember, do you have a sense of when the future land use map was made?
Oh, gosh. Well, Sarasota County had a future land use map even before the Growth Management Act was adopted.
Yeah.
They had a very early countywide comprehensive plan. And so my guess, I mean, that would have been, what, 25 years ago?
At least. So in the late 70s, Julie and I went up to Manatee County and found, we were aware there was a giant cypress tree that took like 7 or 8 people to put their arms around it. And it was in the path of the interstate. The interstate hadn't been built. And so we went to a hearing with DOT about the alignment of the interstate, which was being proposed. And we said, you should move this interstate. And they said, well, you should have been at the hearing in 1969 or 1970. And I said, well, I was trying to get out of high school at the time. If I'd known, I would have come down from New Jersey and testified, but I didn't get that memo. So part of what's going on with this area is that planners thought it made sense to have light industrial zoning or future land use adjacent to the interstate. Like rather than put some park, you know, where people are going to be shipping stuff in and out, rather than having that far away from the interstate, maybe it would make sense to have those uses right next to the interstate. And so the location of the interstate hugging the western margin of the celery fields created this tension between the fact that this was agricultural land that flooded frequently, and yet we really wanted to make it possible for small businesses and light industry to locate next to the interstate so they'd have access to that. And so that's why when you look at the interstate and the area immediately to the east of it, it's this strange light industrial that does, I've driven around in there when it's flooded. And then that segues into the celery field wetland situation. Then you have the resident. I guess I still would fault. It seems like somebody should have taken their magic marker at the 30,000-foot level and said, yeah, I don't know, this is a really big former wetland. Maybe we should keep the future land use a little lower here. But that didn't happen.
Well, and I think you're exactly right that those are the land uses in traditional planning.
Yeah.
Policy
yeah.
approach, that's where you put, you know, like everybody now is going, oh, well, look at all this commercial development at Fruitville and I-75. And I said, well, that's where it's supposed to go.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather it be, be there rather than out east where I am on my 10 acres.
Yeah. Then we get into the argument, though. Some people argue that the interstate is really supposed to be for inter-regional travel and not for local travel. You're not supposed to hop on the interstate to go down to Venice. You're supposed to stay on 41 or something.
So. Yeah, that's the tension between the planners and the transportation planners. So, but quite honestly, now the congestion's so bad everywhere. It's sort of six of one, half a dozen of the other. Yeah. You either don't have a good road to get there or traffic's backed up on the interstate and
can't get there. We keep adding lanes and new roads. And when was the last time we built a new two-lane road? All our new roads are like four lanes or six lanes or whatever. I don't know what's going on.
Well, they're being built for all the people that they believe the county's going to keep approving and have them come.
That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. All right, so let's – we talked about it generally, but let's talk a little about how this FLUDRA process is going to start. And that's – you said on the 11th of September?
Yes.
And it's and correct me if I got this wrong, there'll be representatives from the Smith Farm, from their family, and representatives from the D.R. Horton, and then the county. Who will actually be – when they go off in a little room to – mediate, who will be representing the county in that situation?
The only one that I know of for sure is David Pierce, who's one of the assistant county attorneys, and he's the one handling this matter.
Okay.
My guess is there would probably also be someone from the administration there.
Okay.
As I understand it, the assistant county administrator that managed this area, but the subject matter divisions, I believe is the one that resigned this summer.
Yeah.
So it's possible that there could be someone else from the county with him, or it may be David Pierce taking this, you know, maybe somebody from planning. So the statute looks for there to be someone with some level of authority involved in the mediation. But ultimately, the only decision makers for the county in this is the county commission.
Okay.
So whatever's decided among the parties. And I don't know, so far I've only seen the attorney that's representing D.R. Horton. I would hope that the Smiths would be present in these discussions.
All right.
But I can't say for sure.
Okay. And so where does Mr. Pierce, what are his... to his marching orders, or how has he been advised as to what he should bring up or not bring up?
That's a really good question. Yeah. We don't know.
Okay.
I'm hoping that everything's on the table. I would think it would be.
Should be.
I do think that another development proposal, in my humble opinion, is very likely to be denied by the county, by the Board of County Commissioners. You know, if there's a settlement agreement that's got viability in being approved by the Sarasota County Commission, I would think it'd have to be a radical change from what D.R. Horton proposed. So extremely great deal less development. Commissioner Smith, I thought, had a pretty interesting idea in his comments on his denial vote. That said, you know, basically, if I knew 100,000 people were coming to land adjacent to me, land adjacent to land I want to develop, which is the visitors to celery fields, I'd come up with a way to benefit from that. You know, so some sort of ecotourism, burgers retreat type thing, something like that speaking just for me,
yeah,
I could see that being a viable option.
We had talked about that with the discussion about those quad parcels, was that somebody could have a retreat center or a motel or something that, and what I think what I put on the table is because the, I won't attribute this to the Smith farm, but I was saying one of the quads could be further excavated to create new habitat. And then you could have both your rooms and the restaurant looking out over this, situation. So people could get out of bed and put their sliding glass door and put a spotting scope. And my idea was to have a wetland with standing water that would be permanent water body. And then you would go and get, you would find dead pine trees, which the center wood, the heartwood, is resinous and takes years to decompose. So you would stick these in the ground and create this forest of dead trees, which would then become a roosting and nesting area for all sorts of wading birds. And in fact, if you've ever been to Avery Island where they make the hot sauce, they went out in a wetland and just put up a frame and laid bamboo across the top, and all these egrets came and nested there. Well, so it's relatively easy to make habitat that birds will want to use. And so, yeah, you could start in your pajamas looking at these birds, and then you could go down and have breakfast and then walk over to the celery field. So that's certainly a theoretical potential. I don't know if it would appeal to the Smith family, but.
Well, and I'm pretty sure it wouldn't appeal to D.R. Horton.
Yes.
As their proposal. But part of the thing that I've seen happen in Sarasota County over the years is that more and more of the developers seem to believe that they have the right to maximize their profits. And what I see us getting, and this is just me speaking as a resident, is a lot of cookie cutter approach.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to go strip mine the land and put cookie cutter, the same layout could have been done in 50 jillion other places in the country.
Yeah.
You know, it's no, sensitivity to environment or any of the things that make our land special. But there is no legal right to maximize your profit.
Yeah. So otherwise we'd have a casino on every parcel.
And so to circle back to Bert Harris for a minute. So everybody thought, oh, Bert Harris gave the developers the right to get paid for whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
And in actuality, Bert Harris Act has been a very limited benefit to developers. Most of their Bert Harris actions, particularly in our area, have not gone anywhere because it requires that their use be a reasonable investment-backed expectation.
Yeah.
So to buy a piece of land on the hope that you get it rezoned,
right,
and you want to get paid back for not getting your rezone, that's not part of Bert Harris. That's not a reasonable investment back expectation.
So it puts these developers in a position of coming into court and saying, well, when we bought the land, we had a compliant commission that did what we wanted, and now you've gone and elected people that are trying to follow the comprehensive plan, and that's screwing up our financial planning.
That's right. Yeah. So could I take just a minute to talk about Senate Bill 180?
Well, you can, but we could probably do a couple of shows on it. But yes, listeners need to know about Senate Bill 180. They need to know that the legislative delegation meetings are coming up, and
yes,
they need to get hooked up and go tell people this is a travesty. But tell us about Senate Bill 180.
And very, very briefly, what Senate Bill 180 has done functionally is tie the hands of local governments across the state to make any changes to their comp plan, changes to their development regulations, or any kind of development orders that increase the burden on new development or make it more difficult or burdensome to develop. So the bill started out, patterned after a previous bill to help redevelopment of areas that are impacted by hurricanes. I don't know that any of us would argue against that being a good policy, that being a good thing. But what happened between that goal and what Senate Bill 180 became is it went on steroids. So it's not limited to assisting people who are trying to rebuild or repair after hurricane damage. It is blanket across, I believe, that it impacts all 67 counties and all municipalities in the state because they were all under some level of threat from an active hurricane in a corridor as defined in the act last year. And this lasts for 3 years.
And, so, it's retroactive, right?
Yes, it was retroactive, possibly because of Manatee County's attempt to resurrect some wetlands buffer requirements. So I can't remember the exact date, but basically to about the middle of last year.
Yeah.
So it's trying to do a good thing that then got completely turned upside down. And right now, literally, there's very little that any county commission or municipality can do to change their regulations if it's going to increase the burden on new development, whether that development has anything to do with hurricane damage, anything, it's just a completely divorced from that.
And then if a hurricane hits the peninsula this year, it stacks.
It extends it more.
This is a trend we're seeing both at the federal level and the state level is let's declare an emergency. I'm going to invoke special powers that were given years ago that we thought would be used judiciously in the event of an actual emergency. And I'm going to pervert the process so that I can do whatever the hell I want, and it's all under the guise of it being an emergency.
So I mean, I'm hopeful that a lot of the legislators have gone on record as saying, oh, they didn't understand that that's what it was doing. They thought it was like the old thing. So I don't have it in front of me right now. I know it's in November that the legislative delegation will be in South County Chambers. So it's in the Sarasota County Chambers in Venice. And you do need to reach out in advance to Representative Fiona McFarland's office. There's a sign-up form that they can email to you that you can at least go ahead and get your place in line. I think it's really important for people to show up and say, this makes no sense. Our board can't even adopt floodplain protection regulations that would help improve public health, safety, and welfare. So it's way too far. Going to last too long, and I'm hopeful that it'll get revised.
And there are some counties that are already challenging it legally. But I would definitely recommend if you never have been to a legislative delegation meeting, and I can say with authority that almost no one has, what you see at these meetings is every single nonprofit and the hospital and the USF and New College and every entity that would like some favor from the Florida legislature shows up and makes a case, and very few citizens show up. And and you can submit if you have, PowerPoint or something you want to provide to them. You can provide materials in advance, and that'll be included in their packet. So it's both really educational because you learn. For instance, the town of Longboat Key regularly shows up and says they need legislation to help with rising sea level, which is you're not supposed to talk about it, but they've figured it out that that's an issue on Longboat Key. So, get in touch with Fiona McFarland's office and tell them you would like to be a speaker at the legislative delegation meeting for Sarasota County. There's another one for Manatee, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're in Sarasota or Manatee, contact your legislator and tell them you want to speak.
And the last thing I'd like to say is I do believe we have a Sarasota County Commission right now that is willing to listen to residents. And so don't stay at home. Sometimes it's easy to just listen to the meetings online or watch them on your computer. But showing up and talking to the commissioners, they actually want to hear from us. And yes, I hope to see you at the next public hearings.
Yeah, it's a better commission than we've had in quite a while. It's not perfect, but it's better. So, Susan, if people want to get in touch, either with Keep Country Country or SCAN, how would they do that?
Keep the Country would be at SarasotaCountry.net would be their website. And for SCAN, I believe the email address, and it's all lowercase, Sarasota Citizen Action Network @gmail.com. And that'll take you to Tom Matrullo, and he's the one that sort of handles all the information right. distribution and our email list.
And SCAN also has a Facebook presence, right?
Yes, there's a lot. I don't know that it's a SCAN page per se, but Tom has a lot of social media places where he posts information. So that's another way to hook up with it. And Keep the Country is primarily still focused on trying to preserve the rural lands that we have left.
Yeah, around Old Mahaca.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have a couple of minutes left. Talk a little bit if individuals were interested in attending, even though a lot of it's behind closed doors, how do you see the September 11th mediation going, and what would it be like if someone showed up for that?
So the meeting, it's not a meeting, it's a hearing,
right.
Is officially by statute open to the public.
Okay.
So anyone can come and sit in there and listen. My expectation on the meeting on the 11th is that the hearing would begin sometime around 9 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
It is in the North County Commission chambers on Ringling. And I believe there'll probably be some preliminary discussions among the parties. We, as members of the public, can sit there and listen to those. And then I would expect that the county and D.R. Horton and potentially the Smiths would go off and either mediate with the special magistrate going back and forth between them, or all sit down at a table and negotiate to see if there's any possible settlement. If there is a possible settlement or they agree on a potential settlement, that would come back and be briefly presented to the special magistrate, and those of us in the audience would see and hear that as well. Then, depending on the timing, there may be an opportunity for very brief comment by interested members of the public. I'll explain what that is in a second, to comment on the settlement proposal. So at that first hearing, we would not be talking about why that first development that was denied was not a good idea. We'd be responding to the specific settlement proposal.
Okay.
And again, the only people from the public that have been recognized as potentially having a right to speak at the hearing are those people that spoke at the County Commission final public hearing, which was, I believe it was February 12th, 2025.
All right. That's helpful. Community Harvest SRQ will host the Local Regeneration Study Series, a monthly book club through September. The book for September is The Power of Just Doing Stuff by Rob Hopkins. Books are available at the Community Harvest SRQ Sarasota office. The September book discussion will take place on Thursday, September 25th at 6:30 p.m. at the Resilience Incubator, which is at 1760 Mound Street in Sarasota. More information is available by email Andrew at communityharvestsrq.org. You've been listening to our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR Radio, 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear us on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online. Today's show number 68 featured Susan Shetley talking about the Smith Farm, D.R. Horton, and Fludra. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. Previous shows of our Changing Environment may be accessed at WSLR Archives. Go to archive.org www.wslr. And I think that's about all we have.
Thanks, Jono.